Quick update, I'm launching a new course for 2025. It's Foundations of Application Security. It's a two-day bootcamp covering everything you need to become a well-rounded AppSec practitioner. There's both public and private courses available, and the best part about it all is taught by me. So if you're interested, just send me an email, call@galahcyber.com.au, or say hi on LinkedIn if you can have a chat about it.
Hi, I'm Cole Cornford, and this is Secured, the podcast that dives deep into the world of application security. Today, I'm talking to Bruce Large, security architect and evangelist at Secolv, Australia's foremost OT security consultancy. I think Bruce brings some super great insight into the space. He's definitely brought me up to speed on all sorts of things like the PLC Top 20 and all of these engineering standards, which I didn't really know because I don't get involved in the space all that much. He brings great insight into the space, whether as a chartered engineer or a community leader, and he's just a genuine and good-natured dude. So I hope you get a lot out of this episode. And I'm joined by Bruce Large. Bruce, how are you going today, mate?
I'm going good, Cole. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolute pleasure. How's the day been? We're recording the day after Anzac Day, and I'm surprised that you have not done what most people do and taken an extended super long weekend.
Yeah, I think there was a bit of a calendar situational awareness fail on my part. The day is good, but I think I've had too much coffee and I'm starting to see sound. So we should be in for an exciting podcast today.
All right. Well, if you start buzzing, I'll try to put you down a little bit. So
yeah, thanks, mate.
So Bruce, maybe for our audience, maybe give us a bit of background about, you know, who you are and where'd you come from?
Yeah, no, thanks, man. And yeah, awesome to be on your podcast. I'm a big fan. I think we actually first met at B-Sides Brisbane from memory. The first B-Sides, I think. And it's been very exciting since. I've recently moved to a company called Secolv. We're an OT, operational technology, cybersecurity startup. And I have kind of two hats. I'm a principal OT cybersecurity architect. So that's my background. I'm actually a chartered engineer. So I do, you know, telecommunications engineering and focus on cybersecurity. And my other hat is the chief evangelist, which is very exciting because, you know, I'm very active in the community and I enjoy, you know, teaching people about operational technology, cybersecurity. You know, I'm involved with like the SANS community, involved with different electrical engineering, telecommunications groups. And just, it's actually really cool to work for a company that acknowledges that, you know, we can help improve the community. And I really, really like that.
Yeah. There's two things I wanted to talk through about just like quickly on those. Engineers Australia and like chartered engineer, I know that most people listening to my podcast are pretty much only really dealt with like software engineers, not so much civil or electrical or whatever. So, but would you be able to just like clarify a bit more about what the difference is between one?
Yeah, definitely. Yep. So I'm actually currently the chair of the Information, Telecommunications and Electronics Engineering College in Queensland. So we're called the ITEE. ITEE covers things like software engineering, mechatronics, control systems, telecommunications, electronics. This is a term that often comes up. You know, we make jokes around big E engineering, little E engineering, but it really comes down to what in Queensland we call it is a professional engineering service. So we have a thing called the Professional Engineering Act from, I think, 1924 from memory. Queensland was the first state in Australia to actually have the requirement of if you're providing a professional engineering service, you have to be registered. There are multiple ways to get registration. I personally am a chartered professional engineer of Engineers Australia, but there's other methods like being a registered professional engineer through Professionals Australia. And for people who registered prior to 2008, they actually registered directly with the Board of Professional Engineers of Queensland. The moral of the story, though, is what is a professional engineering service? And there is guidance from the Board of Professional Engineers Queensland, the BPEQ, but it really comes down to the application of engineering knowledge, the use of advanced mathematical calculations, and most importantly, if you're providing judgment that is not in what we call a prescriptive standard. Now, in my world, operational technology, we'll talk about a thing called the Purdue model. So the Purdue model, it's an abused model, but it basically is around the different functional levels in a control system. It kind of originally started out with the ISA, International Society of Automation, and how to connect IT systems into computer manufacturing systems. Probably say the late 80s, people was plugging computer networks together. Everything got pretty crazy. So they decided we need to come together to figure out how do we actually interconnect IT and operational technology or industrial control system applications. So for me, a simpler way to kind of pull through all that is, has it got a real life safety impact? And if it does, what is that engineering rigor or engineering, professional engineering service around that, right? So in my world, if you think about things like power systems, water systems, transport systems, things that can actually, you know, endanger society, there really needs to be some sort of engineering, you know, and the public have an expectation of the safety and things like that. And importantly, as a chartered and registered engineer, and they are different terms, but as a registered engineer, you can be held accountable for bad practice. You can be fined, you can be disregistered. And I think in IT, we just have this blurring of terminology of what's engineering and what's not. I personally try not to get triggered by it. It is difficult, but I think at the end of the day, from an engineer's perspective, as in a professional engineer's perspective, some of the stuff that software engineers do, we would call, you know, what we would call a technician, right? However, there is a difference between software development and software engineering, right? And depending on your context, one's not right or wrong. It's just which one's the right fit for the job.
Yeah, I think there's also a lot of malpractice would be considered if you, the way that we went about software engineering was considered from a normal engineering lens. So
yeah, yeah.
I think that we have to cut corners. We have to, like, if you're trying to release at scale and to respond to changing market conditions, there's no way that you can do it if you are like having the rigors in place from early waterfall based software development.
Yep.
And so I think that where it makes sense to have that level of rigor, then I definitely see people applying like a good AppSec practices, good software quality practices, building and thinking through preconditions, postconditions, and all this kind of stuff. And so that would be like building, let's say, spacecraft or cars, pacemakers, and medical devices, you know, those kind of things where the consequence for making a mistake is threat to human life, it's safety, it's, you know, just like tremendous damage. But if you're building a, just a standard SaaS web application that, you know, what's the consequence if it goes offline? Oh, a couple of people can't upload expense receipts and they'll get mildly annoyed. You just cut corners, man. And so I don't think there is really as much, I guess, like the software engineering discipline itself doesn't really put the engineering into it all that much anymore.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it really comes down to that scoping exercise, right? And I'm very excited today to be able to talk to someone like yourself who has an awesome following of security and application security practitioners to talk about something that's actually probably just not really well understood, right? Which is, how do we do product security for operational technology components? So I don't know. I'm happy to jump into kind of my first thought on the topic.
Yeah, let's get into it. Tell me more.
So I've had the pleasure of going back to universities and speaking to engineering students, right? And they'll often ask, hey, Bruce, like, what's the one thing I could do or what should I focus on? And for me, it's actually teaching people who create operational technology components to think about threat modeling, right? So too often in these systems, the focus is on functional outcome, right? Like, I need my system to achieve XYZ in these constraints in this economical manner. Unfortunately, not everyone considers a hostile operating environment, right? So if you think about engineering and building like robust engineering systems, a term actually from my finance degree is endogenous and exogenous, right? So threats that exist inside the system versus threats that are outside the system. So in cybersecurity, and we think about cyber physical systems, we're dealing with motivated threat actors, right? They have a goal. They're trying to achieve some impact to a system. They will find the weakest link. I've made a joke previously around, it's like the velociraptors in Jurassic Park, right? They will attack you at your weakest. Now, some engineers don't really think around those abuse use cases, right? So how could my system be attacked? And often they don't understand or consider that their system might be a stepping stone to a bigger objective, right? If we think to some kind of, you know, OT security incidents, we think about things like, you know, Stuxnet. You know, would a Siemens engineer think that their product could actually be the fifth domain of warfare? Unlikely. You know, maybe thinking about, say, communication vendors that create, you know, serial gateways, they're not always considering that their device might actually be controlling super important critical national infrastructure and could be targeted by an incredibly hostile adversary, right? So for me, I think just having that time in design, because 90% of your operational life expenses are locked in at the design phase. It's incredibly hard for these systems to be updated, upgraded, or changed once they're in production, right? So I think, yeah, when I chat to engineers, just taking some time to red team the design, right? And think around, if I was a hostile actor in the system, what could I do? And yeah, we get into things like applying, you know, Stride to operational technology systems. Even just having that conversation around, what are the trust boundaries? What are the interfaces? What are the undocumented engineering interfaces? And I just think if there's only one takeaway people take from this conversation, it's there's an incredible amount of benefit to doing a desktop threat modeling exercise in the design phase.
I agree. And I guess I see it a lot of time just in the broader product security ecosystem as well, where people have just chosen to go ahead with a design without spending the time to do a threat model in advance. Obviously, vulnerabilities are, you need to be fixing them, but they're only vulnerabilities if there is a threat actor that has an intent to actually act on it and cause some kind of damage to your system. And I think a lot of people misunderstand that there are threats who do want to be acting on and causing damage to these systems, right? And yeah, we listen to all those spy movies and stuff, and people say it's not going to matter to me. All I'm doing is just like assembling a couple of widgets to throw on a conveyor belt. And then that conveyor belt is somehow ends up in an airport, and then the airport somehow, yep. And then three, you know, 4 or 5 steps later, that's the way that, you know, the ocean's 11, 6 different degrees of.
Yeah, definitely.
You know what I mean? When they go through and do all sorts of crazy shenanigans that only exist in the movies, except they absolutely do happen in real life. And it's because people have just opened, left doors open in 50 places at once. Yeah, we're always going to be taking the easiest route to get into a system where we can. But yeah, I think it makes sense.
Yeah. And I mean, and threat actors. Yeah, threat actors will find that least path of resistance, right? They're goal-orientated. I always kind of come back to, you know, the P in APT is persistent. So they will be always testing to find a least path of resistance, right? And I guess that's where it's that holistic whole-of-system engineering approach that should be addressed. But anyway, that's probably enough of me waxing lyrical about threat modeling. But I just think, you know, it's such a fundamental concept that we need to be teaching people, right? And I guess actually just a very quick aside, I remember listening years ago to a podcast of, if we think about how we teach tradespeople how to be safe from day one. So, you know, think you're an electrician. Day one, we teach people how to work with electricity in a safe manner. We don't really do the same when we teach people software development, right? We just teach them, build it as quick as possible, iterate quickly, deliver value. We probably should be teaching them earlier in their education that application security matters. And it might have actually been on one of your podcasts, Cole, that I remember listening to this. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the interesting things, because I come back to this a lot, is where do we start? Do we start by educating people at high school or at university or as they enter the workforce or when they're already in the workforce and have transitioned? Like, at what stage is it effective to be focusing on, you know, building in these practices and helping engineers to solve those kind of problem, like security issues, right? What I tend to find is that, you know, there's like what, 12 different non-functional requirements. Like, it could be anything from accessibility, internationalization, performance, usability. Security is just one of them. And engineers tend to care about 2 to 3 disciplines that they're really, really super focused on. And it might mean that they're picking up Nix or Bun and some kind of new fandangled component for performance reasons. But because of that, I find it's really difficult for education to be an effective approach unless you're able to give people a regimented and like process-oriented way of building software. And almost every company that I interact with uses fundamentally different ways, loosely based on agile ways of working. So there'll be Scrum, Scrumban, Kanban, whatever, OKRs. So all of these different ways of working. But ultimately, at the end of the day, there is no consistency in how people build software. And because there's no consistency, there's no way to say, here's the regimented way to be effectively given the checklist of, firstly, you need to check to see if you've got a clean area, you've demarcated where the spill is, you've got your PPE on, and all of these kind of checks. And also, people aren't incentivized to do this. Like, if you think about tradies in Australia, to do any kind of job effectively, you need to be registered and licensed and have insurance and have the correct PPE in place to even begin doing the work. And you're only competing against other tradies domestically who have the exact same regulatory like standards on top of them. Whereas with software engineering, you could be competing against people in China, in India, in Vietnam, in America, in Belarus. And these people do not have the same types of limitations. Like, you know, they may just be happy to produce awful software that meets your functional requirements, but has no engineering built around it whatsoever. But the cost does matter to businesses a lot. And so I think it's really hard for us to go out and say, hey, let's look at how we're approaching engineering and bring that into like those kind of mechanisms around safety, around credentialing, around professionalization, when like we're competing against a global talent base. And secondly, there is no consistency to how people even do the work in the first place.
I think it's a really good point you raised there, Cole. I've had this conversation with many people before. I think we actually fix this from the asset side or the buyer side, right? So how do we educate asset operators or people buying software to really value AppSec? Case in example for me, I used to work for a company called Powerlink. It's the transmission network service provider for Queensland. So when you're on the highway, the really big poles and wires, right? And I was the operational technology cybersecurity team leader, and we were building quite a few new kind of OT systems, right? Now, I'm a huge fan of that secure system development lifecycle. And when I came in, there was some really great work, you know, good standards, good architecture. But we were focusing more on validation of security via pen testing. And on some of these projects where we were developing or working with partners to develop software, I actually engaged a AppSec consultant to come in the beginning of the project to just give guidance around system design, system architecture, development best practices, right? And people were like, you know, okay, I get we need to do this, but won't this cost more? Or will this delay the project? And I was like, well, no, it actually makes it better because we won't find these issues at the end of the engagement process, right? Let's push it into the beginning of the process. And it helps too, you know, the Australian Energy Sector Cybersecurity Framework, AES-CSF. It does call out requirements, especially for MIL 3 and Security Profile 3, that you are, you know, embedding secure software development practices into third-party engagements. But I just think we need to change the conversation from this is security making things difficult to this is security enabling us to build better software earlier in the process, so we're not discovering things at the end of the project when we're under time pressure. And I'm actually quite interested in the future watching these projects. You know, can you baseline scope variation or schedule variation, right? Yeah, and obviously you and I, we've had many beers with pen testers. There's a lot of common problems, right? And often it's because developers aren't aware or they haven't received the training. And to your point, I actually think there's probably no like best time to learn it. I think what we should be encouraging is lifelong learning in this field, right? And how do we kind of adapt? And, you know, I think it's really important in some ways, how do we actually unlearn things? How do we actually stay current with, you know, changing systems, methodologies, and approaches?
Well, I'm finding that with a lot of penetration testers right now who've spent a lifetime learning network security and have learned some, you know, Active Directory exploitation. And they're now coming into an environment where companies are increasingly using Okta and WebAuthn and just-in-time privileged access instead of just having domain controllers and or just networks, right? Networks are defined with software. You know, Terraform is instantiates a cloud environment, and we already know what the boxes look like and how they look. Because of that, they're finding that the skills that they learned 15 years ago are becoming, you know, relevant in other areas, but they're getting quite pigeonholed and it's stressing them out. And they feel like there's a constant rat race to stay on top of the technology. And I don't feel like that's the case at all with application security, because fundamentally we're trying to teach people how to fish. Mm. And it turns out that everybody's still got sticks, right? And we have nets and we have poles and we have like even ocean liners, and we know how to do sustainable farming with platform engineering. If we really want to stretch the metaphor,
I'm in for this. Let's go.
Look, let's go on our fishing journey together, Bruce. Yeah. Where are we off to?
I don't know, but let's see if we get a big one for the day.
Yeah. Well, this is a big one. So I it is a challenge. I know that businesses in Australia are also very much aligned a lot more to OT security than in other jurisdictions around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because our economy is really heavily linked to either professional services that support resources or like critical infrastructure. They're not so much aligned to like technology and software engineering. But these companies over here that are in those industries are getting like disrupted by technology firms and increasingly need to start looking at how IT fits into their operations and starting to adopt IT ways of working into their ecosystems, right? And so I'm having more conversations now with like companies that are largely OT firms who see the writing on the wall and want to be moving into that direction. And even this, even with the penetration testers who've had cruisy government workers, contractors, just doing essential eight kind of stuff, are seeing that the skill set is not as useful as it used to be.
Yeah, definitely. And I can't remember the term, but there's this like software's eating the world, right?
Bloody, what's his name? Andreessen Horowitz?
Yeah.
A16Z, I'm pretty certain that he's the guy. Like a while back, I remember doing a prezzo at Parliament House.
No.
Yeah, just casually.
As you do, Cole.
Just what you do, right? You just go to Parliament House and you just talk to people. Don't worry, there was no pollies in the audience. It's just a...
Oh, g'day, Albo.
G'day, Albo. Let's talk about secure software delivery. But I did basically go there and say, hello, government people. We need to be changing how our industry works and we need to focus on professionalization instead of... Yeah, elevating the profiles of cool, effectively burglars and then patting them on the back for just helping each other learn how to burgle better, right? Like, it's not, that's not what we should be doing. At the same time, yeah, like, so I did mention, I'm pretty certain it was Andreessen Horowitz, and like 10 years ago, he said that in his letter, like at the A16Z, as he started his venture firm. And now it's insane how much money and how accurate he was, because like, I think 9 out of the 10 companies on the NASDAQ, like the richest in the world, are software firms. And the 10th richest is Berkshire Hathaway. And the reason it's so rich is because it has a 1/3 stake in Apple. So,
like, yeah.
Yeah, there we go. Look at that.
It is quite profound. And I think one of the issues is our communities and the public don't really have the tools to assess good quality software, right? And that's why we're seeing regulation. And, you know, I think we were chatting before the show around the Biden kind of software executive order stuff, right? And things around S-bombs and all this stuff. Like, I think people are now realizing, wow, we have such complex systems that are built upon complexity and it's unclear, like, what are the foundations, right? And we're having to build regulation to kind of ensure these critical systems have had, you know, security by design and security baked in, as opposed to, you know, move fast, break things, push early, push often, which works perfect in agile use cases, like you were saying before. But if that's like software that's controlling operational technology or critical processes, as a society, we don't really have that appetite. We're happy for it to be a bit slower, right? People often ask me like, hey, well, Bruce, how do I actually do good OT security, right? Yeah, I'm a bit of a zealot, you would say, for the ISA IEC 62443 standard series. It is a complex standard series, right? It's 14, 15 standards, depending how you count. And they're actually a mix of prescriptive standards and informative technical reports, right?
Hmm.
But there's kind of four lenses, if you will, to 62443. There's kind of like the part one series. That's all around terminology, concepts, metrics, things like that. Part two is around administrative policy, whole of organization kind of view, right? And there's an important thing there we call a CSMS, a cybersecurity management system, which is effectively the OT information security management system, right?
Yep.
We outline things like, how do we do training? How do we do risk controls? Those kind of things. We then come to the part three series. That's around systems. That's the one most people are familiar with, right? So part three, two is around risk assessments for operational technology systems. And that's where we have things like zones and conduits. We have things like security level targets, you know, security level target actuals, complete and abilities. We then also have, security level targets. And then at the fourth layer, or the part four series, we have components. And that I think is the most relevant for your audience, right? So how do we actually build robust, the standard series calls them IACS, industrial automation and control systems components. And there's kind of like four categories they have there, right? There's software applications, there are embedded systems. So these are the traditional IEDs, so intelligent electronic devices, relays, remote terminal units, that kind of stuff. Network devices, which I think we can all agree. And then what they kind of just call host devices, which are really kind of like computers and things you use in the environment. But the part four series, I think, is really useful for kind of like your traditional OT vendors to have a framework they can apply for whole of life, secure product security focus, right? So you can get the standards a few different ways. I think the best one is actually if you just sign up to ISA.org, you can view the standards online for free, but you can't like download or print or anything like that. But in part 4.1, it kind of talks to like, what are these foundations, you know, for an actual requirements for secure system development. And it's a pretty good model, kind of talks to things like security management guidelines, how to specify security requirements, which is actually quite good because that's where things like threat modeling and things come out that, you know, we're familiar with.
Yep.
Things like secure by design, secure implementation, and very important things like, well, how do you actually push updates to products, right? So once you've built the system, especially if they're, you know, in difficult places to get to, dangerous places, remote places, it's quite difficult to just do an over-the-air update, right? Especially if it's controlling something safety critical. And then something I really like is what they call security verification and validation, right? So in system engineering, we have this concept called the V model, as in Victor.
Yep.
So we kind of move down design activities and we move up testing and assurance activities. And importantly, rather than just relying on the activities that happened before, you link back to the corresponding design activity, right? So I believe, you know, test-driven development, that kind of thinking,
yep,
but applied into OT. So I think, yeah, that 62443 standards to me is actually a really great place for once you've got past that initial threat modeling, understanding your system context and things. If you're kind of a bit stuck and you're thinking, you know, I don't think OWASP is actually that appropriate, spoiler alert, it is still very useful. but if you're thinking like, I don't know what to do, you know, like I know I have these kind of like requirements and things expected of me, but I'm not building a web app. How do I think about this? I'd actually really encourage you and your listeners to check out 62443 part 4.1. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people, I think, who haven't worked in those kind of ecosystems or spaces or even interacted with people in those spaces just will not recognize that the approaches that work in standard software engineering are not, you just can't do them. You cannot do them. They'll whinge about legacy software and then they'll realize that everything that's hard about legacy software in an enterprise is basically the de facto for embedded systems.
Mm.
You cannot change it for 10 to 15 years. There is no mechanism to be updating like a PLC or an embedded device, right?
Yeah.
And if there was a good mechanism, like you want to make sure that that's very, very safe, right? So,
well, and I mean, I don't know if it's come up in your show before, but have you heard of the year 2038 problem?
Not 2038, but I'm going to assume it's like close to a Y2K issue, right?
Exactly. So this is, you know, Y2K is the Disney version of the year 2038 problem, basically.
Oh, okay.
So the 2038 problem is, you know, Unix time ticks from 1970.
Yep.
In the year 2038, at that point, we will roll over the 32-bit double byte, double word. Yeah, we'll roll over the 32-bit value and we'll actually go back to 1970. Now, unlike Y2K, which were big obvious things like, you know, computer systems, mainframes, whatever, this is every embedded device. So, and I think the feasible solution is just upgrade everything to 128-bit processor architectures. But the 2038 problem is absolutely going to be crazy for operational technology, right?
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more then. So what is the implications of it overflowing back to 1970? Like, how does that affect the types of devices?
It'll be the logic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'll just be the logic, right? So depending on and the use of time, right? So in some industrial processes, having time all in synchronism is incredibly important. If you're thinking about monitoring a process in, for example, electricity industry, there are things called phasor measurement units that measure in real time the power quality, if you will, of the grid. That all relies on GPS, NTP, PTP, like very precise time protocols to understand through the whole network, you know, and we're talking between different states, for example, that the electrical waveform is behaving as expected, right? Depending on complex process control systems, if there's something that relies on time, it will cause a problem. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see what creative ways we find to work around this, right?
Yeah, because it's effectively the really big problem. Besides, like, we know what the solution is, but like the problem is unique for pretty much every single device at that point, right? Because some devices, it will have no impact on whatsoever because it's just the time is not relevant to how it operates.
Yeah.
And then there's other devices that it is a system of record, for example. And then if your records are just fundamentally wrong now at that point, you can't use them.
Yeah.
Or if it's making decisions about when to open or close gates or to...
And maybe it'll be fine because it's all relative time. So yeah, it'll be an interesting one. So
I guarantee there'll be a bunch of programmers who've hard coded specific time values in, and then it's going to do some stupid math badly. And then who knows what's going to happen, right? If my experience in reviewing code is anything, it's just like, people who do not consider the future.
As someone who's written dodgy hacks, I can totally appreciate this.
I see it so often, like where someone's written source code that basically refers to like a hard-coded DNS entry, or like an IP address or just something like that. And then at some point they're like, wow, something's happened. We didn't renew that certificate or the DNS record. We lost access to it, or our company got acquired and deleted those boxes. And then suddenly their mission critical software is broken and they can't fix it.
Yeah.
And it's like, if only I had the foresight.
This brings back painful memories in a previous life when I worked in the railway industry of hardware certificates on locomotives and how do you support that? And, for heaven's sake, do not lose that certificate authority. It's going to be an incredibly bad day. Yes, no, it's exciting. And I think that's why I love OT, right? It interacts with the physical world. Whereas IT, you know, like information systems, like they're interesting, but it's that interface of information systems to the physical real world that I quite like. And I am looking forward to getting down to Newcastle and hanging out with some OT people and your beaches. I've seen the photos. They're quite nice, Cole. So.
Yeah, mate. Like, you better come out. Like, we'll do a walk down Hickson's. I can't say that you'll enjoy it particularly much because, like me, you enjoy beer and T-bone steaks, and that doesn't conduce to 2.5K hill walks down to the beach and back up again.
Oh, no.
Especially if you're carrying a baby like I did last time on Tuesday.
Yeah, no, that's... It's going to be weird if I'm carrying a random baby. Oh, that's
It's just me, mate. You can carry me down the hill. How's that sound? So,
Nah, good one. So, yeah. So, look, I think definitely I'd encourage people, if you are, you know, working around even Internet of Things, Industrial Internet of Things, right? The 62443 standard series is actually really great. Yeah, really great reference for you to use. And I think something that's familiar to engineers as well, right?
Yeah. I wanted to shift gears a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I noticed something you're quite passionate about, which is effectively belonging to a union.
Yeah.
And industrial relations and how important it is for us to be thinking about that. And like, I've worked at companies in the past where like it's literally never come up in conversation because the general vibe is, well, if I don't like my employer, I'm just going to go get a new job as a software engineer somewhere else. And effectively, there have been so many cases where large companies have colluded to reduce wages. Like we've seen that in the mid-2000s with all the big tech firms refusing to poach from each other. And then eventually Facebook coming in and then just starting to raise the bar on salaries and getting rid of that artificial cap and absolutely disrupting the industry. Now, we're not going to get a benefactor company coming to Australia to start doing this kind of stuff. But the other way is actually to look at, like, you know, joining an organization like Professionals Australia. So would you be able to talk about why it's important to be thinking about, like,
yeah.
Also, aside, I'm a business owner and I'm still going out there to talk about unionization. So just a heads
up. No, definitely. would love to. And I'm actually the incoming president for Professional Engineers. So Professionals Australia, and some of your listeners in Australia might remember.
Either way, whatever.
Yeah. Some of your listeners may remember PESMA, right? When I was at uni, so I, you know, graduated uni mid-2000s, APESMA, I think it was the Association of Professionals, Engineers, Scientists and Managers Australia, right? APESMA rebranded to Professionals Australia. We have multiple groups. One of those groups is Professional Engineers. Another group, which would be most applicable to your audience, is MPD, so the Managers and Professionals Division. And that covers IT workers, technology workers. We also cover like scientists, pharmacists, architects, and we also have like kind of alignments to things like local government and Commonwealth, right? Now, one of the groups in Professionals Australia is called the TSI, which is Technology, Software and Information Technology, right? So TSI cuts across all those divisions and basically represents the STEM workers, right? So, you know, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. And it's an exciting time for our industry, right? We're growing. There's a lot of investment. There's a lot of people joining the industry. And people like us, you know, we have a lot of experience. We have a lot of power. We have the ability to easily move jobs, right? But unfortunately, our peers, our more junior peers, comrades, if you will, they don't have that power, right? And I think it's important that as an industry, we kind of say, this is the minimum standard we accept, right? This is how we want to treat each other. And this is how we think as an industry, we should behave, right? And unionism is a way to allow workers to, you know, group together and to use their power to make it a more equitable conversation with management. And what's actually cool about our union is we actually represent managers as well, right? So managing is hard. You and I, we both know this. We've had these conversations.
Yep.
Yeah, people aren't like machines, right? Like people are subjective and, you know, we all, you know, I definitely have good days and bad days, right? So I think it's important that as a union, we kind of find that fair outcome for all parties, right? So we want to find win-win situations. We don't want to, you know, force a company into a point of them being, you know, completely unviable. But at the same time, if that company can only exist by not paying its workers what they deserve, then they probably shouldn't exist, right? And on top of this, as we said earlier, some of these things we should make decisions as a society that we do value quality or we do value, you know, the safety of these systems rather than just the cost. So yeah, so I'd definitely encourage anyone on the podcast, if they have questions about the union, hit me up. And definitely check out professionalsaustralia.org.au, right? It's the best way to kind of see and connect with the union movement. And I think it's important we talk about, like you said, I feel like for some reason it's become a taboo topic when it shouldn't, right? You know, just this very evening, I'm heading out to the Labor Day dinner. It's important to remember, it was actually stonemasons in Melbourne that did the 8-hour day, right? Prior to that, I think it was 10 hours weekdays and 8 hours on a Saturday. But it was actually the stonemasons in Melbourne working together in solidarity to actually achieve positive change for everyone, right? And the more you look into it, things like sick pay, long service leave, superannuation, these are all good labor, working class, union outcomes, right? And, you know, we're knowledge workers. We have a different background. But I think it's important that we actually work together to get a better outcome for all rather than just, you know, a select few becoming incredibly wealthy off the labor of others.
Yeah. And I really wanted to bring this up as well because recently I've been seeing a lot of people in the cybersecurity space working across like penetration testing, governance, risk and compliance, but almost always in consulting firms starting to lose their roles and then having difficulty re-entering the workforce. And a big part of that is that they effectively have no support network and now they're like cutting each other down, trying to get whatever's available like scrappily in the market. And it doesn't have to be this way. So we can support each other. We can work together. I know, again, it's weird because I am technically the management and I have the power and I am the bourgeoisie and people will start fighting me about that kind of stuff.
But the revolution will spare you, comrade.
That's it. You know, Maximilian Robespierre said to me, Cole, today your head's okay. So
no, and look, I think there's a furphy here too that if you're a manager, you're a bad person, right? And I think, you know, I'm a very proud member of the Australian Labor Party. I like to say I'm economically literate, but, you know, not a... we could probably beep that out.
Straight to the promos. I am economically literate.
Yes. Yes. I have a master degree in finance, I'll have you know. But no, I'm part of a group called Business with Labor. And I love our tagline of commercial outcomes with a social conscience, right? So you can make money, but you can be a decent person while doing it. You know, you can make really positive, engaging workplace experiences, right? And I know from our conversations, you 100% do that, mate. And just because you own a business doesn't mean you can't be a decent boss, right? And I think too often companies get too big, right? And they lose that, you know, that magic number of 150. I mean, you would have seen this in startups, right? Like just that.
Yep.
Once that company gets too large and it stops being about the people and the interactions and the culture, and it just becomes about profit and shareholder value and things like that. So yeah, so I think it's an exciting time for our union. There's a lot going on. You know, there's quite a few high profile employers where we're trying to get enterprise bargaining agreements set up. Yeah, definitely. Even if you just check out Professionals Australia on LinkedIn, some really great, I just posted the other day, actually, I can send the link to you for the viewers. But just like, why do you need an enterprise bargaining agreement, right? It's a really important tool to make sure there's equity in the workplace. And unfortunately, there's just not a lot of literacy in industrial relations, right? It's just become this, you know, dare I say, it's probably that Howard era of attacking unions. And we've just seen this constant eroding of union, you know, power. And also union membership, right? Like union membership is incredibly low at the moment. I think it's like 15% in the workforce. And I think as the software and knowledge workers, we're an incredibly new industry, right? What we're probably like, 20, maybe 30 years at best. So it's a good time. If you don't really know, you should go educate yourself, right? And yeah, there's definitely people here to help you with that.
Yeah, I think like there's an unfortunate view that people like construction workers, nurses, miners, teachers, unions are for those. And they're not for us because, you know, we're gonna be the business owner who is rich and exploiting the labor of all the, even though you are the exploited class that's in this case in a lot of the times, and you just may not realize it yet. So anyway, enough about politics. Check out Professionals Australia at some point. Not sponsored. Mate, this has been a really long and awesome conversation with you. I have two last questions to power through before I have to rush to daycare because I know that's yeah. My daughter. She loves me, but not that much.
Mate, so, you got to get the priorities, mate. Yeah, so hit me. What are we?
All right, yes. First question, fast question for you is the best purchase for under $100.
I'm going to be cheeky. You didn't specify what currency. I would actually highly encourage people to join ISA. So if you join ISA.org, I think it's $70 US, so a little bit over 100 Australian. But it's a great way to get access to the ISA standards. And also you can actually join an ISA, I think it's a branch. And in that, you can actually connect with other security practitioners.
Yeah, there you go. Go read some books, get some more knowledge. Question number two, speaking of books, is what's the best book to give a person who's in InfoSec?
Yeah, for OT, I think there's two. So I think if they're a kind of like blue team, architect, engineer, that kind of, I'd actually highly recommend Knapp and Langell's Industrial Network Security. To me, it is the textbook of OT security. I had a Facebook reminder pop up. I think it was 13 years ago I was reading it, version edition one. It's quite a good book. I think for the pen testers, I quite like Hacking ICS Exposed. And I know there's also another Packet Industrial Network Security book as well. But I think depending on your focus, if it's blue team, I'd say Knapp and Langell. If you're red team, either of those two books. And I can send through the links for you.
Yeah, that'd be good. And how about if it's not just to learn pure security stuff, what would you give to someone to just help them grow as a person?
Oh, well, grow as a person? I don't know about growing as a person. You fit me for six there.
How to Win Friends and Influence People.
So just a general book or?
Yep, just a general
book. Because I actually have two if I can.
Okay, go ahead.
I think for OT, and it's not technical, but I'd really recommend the book called Sandworm by Greenberg. Andy Greenberg, he is a journalist for Wired. It's a super great book. Talks about kind of the evolving fifth domain of warfare, right? In terms of just general book, I actually really like a book called Design Your Life, I think by Bill Burnett. It's a book from, I think it might be UCLA in the US, but it's a really good book about making informed decisions and actually taking control of what you want to do in your life, right? And helping people connect with what they like, what they want to do, and just really giving structure to some really big decisions you're going to make. So yeah, Design Your Life. I think it's a really good book. I've recommended it to a few people, and hopefully people like it.
Well, it's better than just like going on autopilot. I know that I've spent a lot of time in my like really early 20s just like figuring this out because I had a couple of critical life events that just made me just say like, wow, okay, life is super short and I need to start figuring my shit out right now because I, at this point, want to be married and have kids. At this point, I'd like to have, you know, financial security. At this point, I want to be doing philanthropic stuff and giving back to the community. Now, I've weirdly enough achieved those kind of goals, which is not really what Design Your Life is supposed to be. You know, you get there, but your time frames might be a little bit ambitious. So,
yeah.
But I highly recommend people doing that introspection and thinking about where you want to be.
Yeah, and I think for some of these things where it takes, you know, it takes a lot of time and an effort to get to where you want to go, it's very hard to do it ad hoc and at random. So nice one. Well, I'll tell you what, it's been a pleasure, Cole. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, mate. I hope you have a wonderful dinner tonight and I'll see you next B-Sides.
Definitely, mate. No, I'll be flying the flag tonight, having a few beers and, mate, very much looking forward to seeing you and everyone at B-Sides Brisbane.
Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of Secured. If you got any feedback at all, feel free to hit us up and let us know. If you'd like to learn more about how Galah Cyber can help keep your business secured, go to galahcyber.com.au.
If you're new to the show or a seasoned veteran, I want to hear from you. I'm always looking to do better as a podcast host and as a person. So tell me about what I can do better. Tell me about the types of people you want on my podcast. Tell me about if the format's working for you or styles need to be switched up. Do I need to interview differently? So on and so forth. I appreciate you sticking with me for almost 30 episodes at this stage. And I hope I can keep learning and you can keep learning and being entertained for many more episodes to come. So please shoot me feedback. I want the good, the bad, and the ugly to pod@galahcyber.com.au. And if you don't like email, hit me up on LinkedIn.